We certainly do.
All right. Okay, ready for me to start?
Thanks, Mosh.
Okay, so I'm going to just move this little doodad down into the corner, whether or not you guys can see it. Yes, I'm going to talk about neurofeedback for autism. Just going to share my experiences and the experiences with the folks that I've been able to work with over time. The presentation will probably take about 10 minutes. If I just go through the slides, I'll be very happy to answer questions. Probably best if the questions are asked after I finish presenting, because I don't know how I can interrupt this and then go for questions and then go back. So I'll just go through it, and then if there are questions, that's great. I'll be happy to answer them. The research literature on neurofeedback for autistic spectrum disorders is weak. Betty Yaroshevich did a right-sided theta alpha reward project in 2001 and got good results. I think she was working at T4 predominantly. Rob Coben has worked with autism really for maybe 15 years, maybe longer, and he's had a variety of approaches and he's done research. Those approaches are always involved with connectivity or coherence trainings. His latest version is four-channel coherence training. It requires you to do a QEG and then some very careful analysis after that in order to arrive at the spots where you're going to do the four-channel training. And I've seen him talk about it. I haven't actually seen that methodology demonstrated, but it's very complicated. In my experience, I found that amplitude training, mostly on the right side of the brain, has been very successful, and also successful in the practices of at least four other experienced Australian clinicians that I've been communicating with over time. And so here's what we have found. Like classic autistic spectrum symptoms would include, I think we'd all agree on this, lack of appropriate social awareness and responsiveness, lack of empathy, sometimes a very stilted formalism in conversation. Certainly we would find obsessive over focus in almost all autistic spectrum people. We do find sensory integration issues at various degrees. You may talk about sensory overload, sensory sensitivities, food allergies, sensory seeking. And for some of the autistic spectrum, we do get speech and language expression difficulties, either pronunciation or a lot of the time they just don't talk much, if at all. Other symptoms that we see, we will often see severe anxiety, we'll often see tantrums or meltdowns. Some autistic people are aggressive, certainly not all of them. And many of them have learning disabilities, impulse control, poor focus and attention. Often you'll see unusual walk. Tiptoe walking is the one that they often point out. And restrictive diet. Often they just won't eat very much of anything. They'll just eat the same thing and that's it. They don't want to try anything else. It may be that the texture of different foods or tastes, they just don't like them and they just won't do it. I think what classifies autistic kids is that from a really early age, they've developed rigid behaviors, and it's very hard to break that rigidity. If you look at comorbidities, clearly ADHD is a comorbidity. Many of the autistic kids will have tics, Tourette's. Epilepsy is not uncommon. Lower intellectual functioning, I think most autistic kids are probably lower intellectual functioning. And when you look at some of these classic symptoms that we've heard about or seen over the years, things like hand flapping, sniffing or licking things, head banging, as well as very little speech, I think that they're probably a sign of lower intellectual functioning just as much as they might be a sign of autism, because lower intellectual functioning kids are doing some of that stuff as well. Another comorbidity would be dyspraxia. Often we talk about, I don't know that the term is exactly social dyspraxia, but certainly low muscle tone and movement issues generally are seen a lot with kids that are on the spectrum. EEG patterns, you know, you generally see excessive slow wave, more pronounced at the back of the brain, but, you know, you often see the whole brain just has got too much slow in it. A lot of instabilities in the EEG. I think Jay Gunkelman was talking about 30 to 40% of people on the spectrum will actually have paroxysms and or epileptiform activity. Fast wave in the EEG is not uncommon. Fast wave may be compensatory. And when I see that there is fast wave in an EEG, this is not just autistic kids, but just generally, it is actually a positive sign because it means that the brain is capable of going at beta, maybe even a little bit of high beta frequency, which means that their brain can actually start up and work. If all you see is very slow wave in an EEG, that's really not a good sign. So fast wave with this group may be compensatory, but you will also see symptoms that are related to fast wave, which are agitation, anxiety, aggression, which is not true just for autistic kids. I differentiate two kinds of autistic kids. There's a lot of ways of defining it because it is a spectrum. It's not one disorder. There are the kids that want affection but get overwhelmed and anxious. They want to affiliate. And then there is the kind that really don't care about affection, and they can get aggressive and will manipulate to get what they want. I will call these types anxious. The one type is anxious and one type is unaffectionate. And I think that for the unaffectionate, I think the old term Asperger's, to me, suited that. But I'm not going to get into that in depth. One of the things that's sort of interesting is this idea that of a failure of maternal bonding. We talk about severe developmental trauma as a failure of bonding. And we look usually at the mother as being the person who simply is unable to bond with their child, or this child's been abused, neglected, et cetera, and then we see that there are issues as a result of that. Well, with autistic spectrum, to me it feels like there is a failure to bond, but it's because the child is not available for bonding and the mother wants to bond and tries to bond. But the child just can't respond. So sort of interesting, those two groups seem to fit together in some way. For both, there's a profound deficit in the ability to emotionally self-regulate. Both have difficulty seeing outside of themselves and outside of their immediate needs. And for both, the low-frequency EEG in the right hemisphere is not intact. So we're talking deltas, thetas, and needs training. We tend to think of these frequencies as limbic and perhaps even brainstem, where some of the research today is moving to the brainstem and the periaqueductal gray matter. So that's just some thoughts on some of the theory. For most ASD sufferers, a calming is really the first order of business, because they come in and they're not behaving. They're having meltdowns. They really can't be contained in a regular school environment. So calming them down is actually the first thing we need to do. For mild calming, I find that CZ minus A2, rewarding 12 to 15 or slightly lower. And you're always going to reward low. And unless you've got a really strong reason to inhibit fast wave, I just monitor the 22 to 36. And you need to differentiate whether there's fast wave and just not muscle activity. So this training suits high functioning autistic spectrum who do have fairly good control over their tantrums and aggression. So, you know, these are the kids that are probably going to a regular school. Their behavior is odd, but they actually can keep up with the curriculum. But they get very anxious about things and need some help just maintaining in that environment. If stronger calming is needed, I look at T4 minus P4, and we're rewarding a little bit lower. And again, we're monitoring 22 to 36 hertz unless there is fast wave. This training is good for calming aggression and anxiety, will help behavioral compliance, and almost always with these kids, you're looking for better sleep onset. They don't fall asleep easily. For very strong calming, you train T4 minus F4, rewarding 5 to 8 hertz or thereabouts. And the inhibits pretty much look the same. This training is very good for calming aggression, agitation, and tantrums. It will improve behavioral compliance and sleep onset. And when we're talking about, okay, how quickly should we see something, with this particular protocol and with the T4 minus P4, I want to see something happening within a couple of sessions. And so I'm not going to do, you know, this particular protocol for 10 sessions and then hope by the end of it there's some slight improvement. If I'm doing T4 minus F4 or T4 minus P4, I want to see a positive change within a couple of sessions. I want to see something. Some thoughts about training and rewarding low frequency. People often ask, well, if I'm inhibiting slow wave, how can I reward slow wave at the same time? Seaburn Fisher, in her response to that question, because this is how she works with people with severe developmental trauma, she just says you always have to inhibit slow wave because that helps stabilize the brain. But you also need to reward the slow wave so that the brain can actually organize itself in those frequencies. Now, that's a psychologist talking neurology, and we always have to be careful when we do that. But in the absence of any other sort of evidence, I figure, well, that's okay to have that as a working idea at this point. But let's look at the way we would actually do that. So if we say to the brain, we want you to produce at least 10 microvolts in the 6 to 9 hertz band. So we set the threshold of the reward at 10 microvolts. So that's our reward. But then we also say to the brain, but we don't want you to produce more than 15 microvolts. So the inhibit for the 6 to 9 hertz is going to sit, that threshold will sit at 15 hertz. So we're basically saying your brain has to live in the 6 to 9 hertz band between 10 and 15 microvolts. And the brain can do that. That's not a difficult thing for the brain to figure out. And we almost always inhibit 5 hertz because that stabilizes the brain. Interestingly, Sturman found that his epileptics all produced too much of that 5 hertz frequency, and he always inhibited it. You know, we talk about rewarding the sleep spindle 13 to 14 hertz over the sensory motor strip, because that's what stabilizes brain function. This is basically what we've developed from Sturman's work. And, you know, you think, well, if I'm training a kid with autistic spectrum issues and he's throwing tantrums, and I'm rewarding, you know, T4 minus F4, and I'm rewarding 5 to 8 hertz, first of all, I'm not on the motor strip at all. And secondly, I'm not rewarding the sleep spindle. So how am I stabilizing the brain? And the answer to me lies in the inhibiting of the 5 hertz. But again, I mean, if you do have somebody who definitely has epileptic or epileptiform activity, you may be looking fairly quickly at including some of that in your protocol. But I have to say that even with all the autistic spectrum kids I've worked with, I've never really had to do that. So, but it just remains an open question of how to train that. Okay, T4 minus F4 definitely calms behavior patterns. In some cases, I found the issue is more sensory than executive. And I've gone back to training T4 minus P4, and that actually worked better. So it's not always that for more calming, you want to go to T4 minus F4, and then for a little bit less calming, you go to T4 minus P4. There's something about whether the sensory thing is really the issue or whether it's the executive. And of course, because the pathways going from parietal to frontal are so huge and they're two-way streets, you go, well, you know, how do we do which one and how do we know? And I would just say it's experience that's going to tell you with that particular client. With both sides, you want to see positive change within a couple of sessions. I mentioned that before. Now, if you do train somebody too low, especially kids, what you see is the reemergence of old bad habits, like all of a sudden the kid will start wetting the bed again. They didn't used to do that. Or all of a sudden the kid used to laugh in a really silly way, but that sort of died down a while ago, and now they're doing it again. That would make you think that maybe you're rewarding a little bit too low and you want to reward a bit higher. Left side of training, and the answer to that is yes, and absolutely yes. Once you actually see the calming and compliance are starting to happen, train the first 10% of the next session on the left. Now, I tend to train for 30 minutes, so 10% would be 3 minutes. And it's just a little touch of faster wave because I want to see what their brain does with it. For some practitioners, CZ minus A1 works fine. Some F3 minus A1. So both, I've heard both and I've had reports that both have been successful. I would start the activation at 13 to 16 hertz. And you just want to see if the client will tolerate it. If they tolerate it, you do it again. If they get too activated, just train the calming until they get calm and then do the activation again. All of these kids will need left-sided training. It's just a matter of how much calming they need before you can introduce it safely. So the first goal is that the client will tolerate it, but then what you're really looking for is better focus so that they actually start getting engaged in schoolwork. And also, training on the left makes people more outgoing and more affiliative. So that's what you want to see as well. This may also help the amount of speech to increase and for the speech to become more relevant because they're paying more attention to the outside world. And the goal over time is to increase how much training you do on the left, maybe 20%, maybe 30%. And to gradually increase the reward frequency until you can get to 15 to 18 hertz. And in a sense, to give the brain normal levels of activation so that they can tolerate it, but then utilize it for focus. High functioning autistic spectrum will need some activation almost from the start. So the kid in year 9 or year 10 who's a little bit odd and who gets anxious, and has started not being able to keep up with schoolwork now, they're missing some school. These kids will need a little bit of calming. Usually I would say starting at CZ, like I said in the beginning, but fairly quickly, within a couple of sessions, you may see that activation is going to help them focus better as well. So keep that in mind. Some other training sites that have some relevance, I think, to training kids on the spectrum. This is an ancient pair of protocols used for oppositional children. The idea was to reward or to train C4 minus PZ, 12 to 15 or lower for calming, and then do some C3 minus FZ reward 15 to 18 for activation. This is a pretty good protocol for oppositional kids, and you may find that you can adapt this for your autistic spectrum. Another protocol that I found for the unempathic autistic spectrum client, these are your Asperger's. They're really, really difficult. The family just is in orbit around their symptoms because the kid becomes demanding, aggressive. And I found training at CZ minus T6, rewarding 12 to 15 hertz or lower, to be very helpful in creating true empathy, which is quite astonishing when you see it, and emotional responsivity. And I've had to go 100 sessions to really get that stabilized, but it has stabilized. So it's a very, very powerful possibility. Other thoughts. If you have access to a full cap EEG, you will be able to see temporal lobe disturbances if they're there. Either address them in conjunction with central issues, or if they're not severe, deal with them after central issues. So, you know, temporal lobe disturbances in these kids may be learning disabilities. And I would try to get the central behavior regulation, attention focus, impulse control regulation. I'd like to get that done before you move to the other stuff. If you do mini-map assessments, you will have a very good handle on central arousal and regulation issues. And if you do suspect temporal lobe issues, you can do mini-maps on the temporal lobes as well. So that's my presentation. Happy to take questions if you have any.
That was fabulous. Thank you, Moish. I'll unmute everybody so you have the opportunity.
Exactly. And errors need to multiply. That's right. That. So I'm more of a, in that sense, I'm not conservative 100%, but I'm more of a left wing conservative.
Maybe unmute everybody and you can unmute yourself. Okay. Let me just.